I think during the month of January, God willing, on Festival, we're going to be exploring Genesis, beginnings. I've come and gone in the book of Genesis. I think I'll preach on Sundays on Revelation, the last book of the Bible, and on Festival, get into Genesis. I want you to open your Bible with me tonight. No more calls. The calls that are on the phone, end them as soon as you can. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. I'm going to anticipate a little of what we're going to be doing tonight. And the earth was without form and void. I hold the view there's a vast gulf of time between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. You'll find a passage in Isaiah that says God created the earth. They translate it, He didn't create it in vain. Just as legitimate to translate it, He created it not a waste and a desolation. It's just as legitimate to translate that second verse, and the earth became a waste and a desolation. You can thank God that the fullness of time when God sent forth His Son included the fact, as I said last time we were live, that the Greek language ruled the world, at least the then known world. Greek is a precise language. Hebrew is not. It has a very small vocabulary, but multiplied meanings and multiplied inflections of meanings. Beginning in 1975, 71 really, but 75 in full meaning, with the uncovering through archaeology of the ancient language of the Canaanites that blew all the archaeological theories by the dig of the king of Damascus or the king of Ebla in that Syrian uncovering of an ancient city that will prove to be as important a find as they uncovered a library of tablets with a language that is really the root source from which many of the biblical Hebrew words come, defying past thoughts of philology and archaeology. And any Hebrew-English lexicon will have to be done and is in the process of being redone, taking into account the root words of that old Canaanite language that comes out of that find in the early 1970s, culminating in the full find about 1975, and I believe will prove to be as important an archaeological find as the Dead Sea Scrolls. And once again, archaeology confirms the Bible and doesn't in any way ever uncover anything to defeat it. But Hebrew has been hard to translate. One word means a lot of things. You are just as legitimate to translate that second verse, and the earth became a waste and a desolation, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Those who believe in the gulf of time between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2, and I'm one of those, believe what we confront then is a recreative period. As God recreates the earth and the universe as we know it, and parts of reality that had suffered a great cataclysm. That cataclysm occurred, in my judgment, when Satan was cast from his position, as Jesus beheld when he saw him cast down. And a third of heaven was emptied of angelic beings that sided with Satan. and that cataclysm that struck the earth changed everything. Satan had been the crowning cherub in the mountain of God, and as the later prophet saw, was in Eden before there was a fall, as we see in the Genesis chapter. Jeremiah saw the earth when there were meeting places of intelligent beings, but there was no man on it. And then he saw a cataclysm strike it. Uses the same word as Genesis 1:2. And the earth became a waste and a desolation. Now those who do not believe in the cataclysm between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2 have to put it somewhere around the flood. I don't share that view. And as God began to recreate, He created man, placed him in the garden, gave him dominion over the earth. Then comes the serpent in chapter 3. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, Yea, hath God said? He started out quoting scripture, you notice that? Twisting it a little bit. He led man to sin. Man believed the devil instead of God. The punishment was God drove man out of the garden. And this may be tough on the ERA, but the punishment for what Eve did, I've said before, I don't like any of the things I have to suffer because of that bonehead Adam. I insist and will insist to my dying day I would have done it different. But I still have to bear the consequences. You women that don't like your place, get mad at Eve. Don't get mad at me. Don't get mad at God. And try as you will to change it. It ain't going to work. And you women's libbers out there, Eve messed it up. And God cursed them for what they did. And when the woman failed, he said to her, well, he got on to the serpent first. He said to the serpent, because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field. Now, I don't know what the serpent looked like. And I don't know what shape or form the devil entered into that was the serpent that beguiled Eve. Says he was more subtle than any beast of the field. And I don't think anybody will ever know. All we know is what that tabernacle of Satan expression became after God cursed it. Now, the serpent wasn't the devil. The devil entered into that serpent. Now, he's still called that old serpent, whatever the devil is. He's called that clear up to the end in the book of Revelation. I don't even know for sure that the crawling beasts that we now call serpent were the outgrowth of whatever beast it was that Satan entered into and beguiled Eve. I don't know what the former shape called the serpent actually was. I believe he entered into a creature of a different form and a different shape and a different nature of mobility and movement. And the curse on that beast into which Satan entered Because you see, the pigs wouldn't even cooperate with the devils in the New Testament. When demons entered into them, they ran off into the Sea of Galilee, killed themselves. I happen to believe the serpent as we now know it is the changed form of whatever that vehicle or tabernacle of beastly flesh was into which Satan entered. But the alternative is, because of the curse, the crawling things could have been given the name. The Hebrew is so ambiguous, we just know there was a being there, an evil presence, called the serpent. He's still called that, and he has certainly a different shape in the book of Revelation. But the curse was, thou art cursed above all cattle, and upon every beast of the field, and upon thy belly shalt thou go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. And when I get into teaching verse by verse in Genesis, I'll give you some more on the words being translated serpent. But he says, I'll put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Unto the woman, he said, and that verse contains all the prophecy in one kernel, one seed, to be later unfolded in this book of God. I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Now, there's profound mysteries in that, because Satan is the target of the prophecy. And every prophecy student teaches that this isn't saying a snake will bite the heel of a woman, it's children. It speaks of that enmity between Satan and his offspring, spiritual offspring, and the offspring of the woman. And that bruising of the heel occurs every time Satan is winning a victory against God's redemptive purposes. And that bruising of the head occurs every time God, through his chosen ones, his spirit-filled and spirit-led ones, puts a stomp on the head of the devil. It happened at Calvary when Christ was bruised for our iniquities. But the old serpent was bruised too, because he seized from him the power of death and the keys of death, hell, and the grave, and bought our redemption. Unto the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. I want to tell you something. If men had to have babies, there wouldn't be as many kids in the world. But that's part of the curse, that pain. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband. That means your wants, women, have to submit to the wants of the husband. It's just plain not fair. I'd get mad if I were you women, that you have to go through life submitting to some bonehead man because of what Eve did. Have a fit. In fact, once in a while you can grit your teeth and say, if it weren't for Eve. I've been preaching for a long, long time. God does what he says and says what he's going to do. Now, if the ERA passes, I won't change God's plan a quarter turn. Thy desire shall be to thy husband. You ask me, has that been abused by stinking, rotten, low-down men? You better believe it has. If you got one that won't abuse it, stay up an extra hour tonight and thank God for your wondrous goodness as you look up to Him. But don't abuse the good thing you got. It's part of the curse, women. That damnable Eve, listening to that serpent, eating of that tree, and deceiving her husband. You all have to pay the price till Jesus comes again. Just like I pay the price for the danged idiot listening to the woman. And He shall rule over thee. Boy, am I losing supporters tonight. Because there are more women out there that control the first strings than men. Unto Adam He said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, that ought to scare the liver out of you next time you start listening to your old woman. I have a hard time getting past these verses because I could do something with them tonight, and I will in January. Because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for thy sake. You want to know why, men, it's so tough to make do? That idiot Adam who listened and hearkened to that woman, the reason you have to work so hard to feed those kids and to support that wife, she doesn't have to get out there now. Everybody's trying to change it. The woman wants, because she hasn't had enough time in it, she wants to enjoy the man's curse. Because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Boy, he's going to founder us on it. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread till thou return unto the ground. For out of it, that is the ground, wast thou taken. For dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. And Adam called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all living. That graveyard across the way, they're to blame. Forest lawn over there across from King's House 1, these two did it. And God said, behold, the man has become as one of us to know good and evil. Now lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. He drove out man, sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from whence he was taken. So he drove out man, he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. Then they had kids. Cain and Abel. And they got in a fight. And Cain killed Abel. And then they had Seth. And they lived for hundreds of years. Now, I want to look around me tonight. How many of you think you were smarter than you were a year ago? Huh? You're smarter than you were a year ago? Any of you over there that lament over the fact that youth is wasted on the youth? Have you ever whispered as you get 40, 50, 60, 70, 80? If you had the strength and were 30 years old so you could look forward to 40 more good years, knowing what you know now, couldn't you cut a swath? Huh? You got any cameras on my intelligent crowd over there? that true or false? How many of you would like to start over knowing what you know now? Huh? Well, how many of you know some of these people lived 800-900 years? Does that give you any idea how smart? And they started out smart. Their teacher was God. And the devil, he no dummy. Nothing wrong with their smarts. Now, can you imagine? I've learned more in the last 5 years than I did the previous 10 years. Anybody else think that's the way it is? I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to be so smart, another 5 years going to blow my head open by comparison to what I've been. I can't hardly wait to get as smart as I'll be 20 years from now. It compounds. Now, you have any idea how smart you'd be if you could just keep going at the rate you're going, learning, time you're 800? I'm talking about smarts. I'm serious. I'm dead serious. You know how smart you'd be? I mean, think how smart Einstein would have been if he had had youth, eyes undimmed, and strength, and could have continued to compound his accumulated knowledge until he was 800 years old. No weaknesses and sicknesses like we have now. I mean, they didn't turn half blind at 60, knee joints out of whack, arthritic, and live 30 years able to fight like Muhammad Ali, and then 770 years in arthritic numbness. I can never get past Ethel when she cracks up. I mean, with her sense of humor at her age, think about how funny she'd find life if she were 700 years old. I want you to understand that there were some geniuses running around by our standards. And they began to multiply, and they were evil. Some strange things happened in Genesis. I mean, it's a crazy, crazy scene. Talks about how long they lived. These are the book of the generations of Adam, chapter 5. If you're not interested in this, go somewhere else. I'm interested in it. Adam lived 130 years and had a kid in his own likeness. He called him Seth. In the days of Adam, after he had begotten Seth, were 800 years. Dad. You begat me. Do it again. I said, Dad, you begat me. Do what you did again. Can you imagine living 800? Wait a minute, I'm 52. Can you imagine living 748 more years? You'd be smart. And all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died about time. And Seth lived 105 years and begat Enos. I mean, just think of it, Stan. You and Ethel could have played around in your youth until you were 105 before you even had to change anybody's diapers. Ethel said, that's great. And then Seth lived after he begat Enos 807 years, still begatten. And all the days of Seth were 912 years. And he died. Again, I'd say, about time. I want you to get that picture. They lived a while. You got that? It came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair. Now, there's strange goings on this earth in those days. That the sons of God... See, I don't know about this serpent when he was tempting Eve. I mean, I know I get feelings about snakes that are emotive and subconscious. I mean, I used to hike into the 3,000-foot deep Ball Rock Canyon before they built the big Orville Dam, flooded it, and let everybody get into the place that only a few of us, and my mother said crazy people in Northern California, knew the secret ways to get into that canyon. Best trout fishing in the whole Feather River country in those days. But boy, I could never control myself when I was clambering around the rocks and I hear that bzzz of a rattlesnake. I don't even know how I did it. I just was suddenly out in the air and in the middle of the stream. And it better be where I could get back, because if I heard a rattlesnake buzz, I flew. I hate snakes. Can't understand people having snakes as pets. Now, in ancient Egypt, they used to keep them, wrap them around their neck as a means of cooling themselves, some of the royal women. Yuck. But I don't think the devil's a snake in that earthly sense. I think there's some kind of subconscious, primordial urge against him in me. I don't know what the shape of that being called a serpent was. But I know the translation here, and I'm going to wait till I'm teaching on Genesis. These are angels. Supernatural beings, for want of a better word. The word angel just comes from the word that means messenger. These are denizens of eternity. Beings of the nature that we read about in Daniel, Michael, Satan, who in the book of Job appeared in the councils of heaven with the sons of God. These supernatural beings, of which a third of them joined with Satan when he rebelled against God. And Jesus said, I saw Satan, Lucifer, cast down. These obviously were not good, for want of a better word. And angels is not an adequate word. Sons of God's the right one. These supernatural beings were obviously not of the two-thirds that remained with God, because it was never God's will for them to do what they were doing here. And in heaven, forever, O Lord, thy will is, or thy word settled in heaven. So these had to be of the fallen crowd that were with Lucifer, the prince of the power of the air. The sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair. And they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare, you notice the word children is in italics, added by the translators. They bore offspring to them, and the same, those offspring, became mighty men which were of old men of renown. There's a reason why that's the verse about giants. strange happenings in those days. And God saw that the wickedness of man was very great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. The Lord said, I will destroy man, whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Now these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God, and Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth was corrupt before God, and God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make me an ark. And he told him how to do it. God wiped out and judged this earth with a flood and spared Noah, his wife, his three sons, their wives. God started over with Noah and his three sons, and Noah no sooner touched down on dry land and planted a vineyard than he got drunk. In a drunken stupor, he's laying naked. His son Ham sees him. Josephus records that he laughed and mocked. The other two sons got a covering and backed up and covered their father. And Noah cursed the descendants of Ham, particularly through Canaan. Blessed Japheth with a blessing of enlargement, which I have preached upon, and promised to Shem a unique blessing that flows through Abram, as we know, ultimately in Christ and in the chosen people. I've been reading, you know, a lot in my library of late. But that little background for a minute, I want to intrigue you a bit for Genesis and for our Holy Land trip. It's 11 o'clock. My Lord, help us. Everybody knows about the pyramids in Egypt. Who here hasn't heard of the pyramids? Everybody knows about the pyramids. What you don't know, I'm sure a lot of you, is the nature of those pyramids, all of them, but particularly the biggest one, credited traditionally to Cheops, one of the rulers of the dynasty, and thought originally to be built solely for his tomb. Can I read you something? How many of you know that Abram from Mount Gerizim in his day could see the light reflecting off those pyramids covered in that day with polished limestone? Stripped off by the Arabs when they didn't find riches in the tomb, and used to build their very mosques in Egypt. But in the day of its glory, and in Abram's day, covered with shimmering limestone that reflected the light, and they could be seen by Abram. Not too many people know the influence that pyramid had on Napoleon. He came out of the chamber, the king's chamber, where the sarcophagus, which has the exact measurements of the Ark of the Covenant. You know, there's a lot of truth in the Raiders of the Lost Ark and a lot of Hollywood in it. But it has the exact measurements of the Ark of the Covenant. He stood in that king's chamber alone, came out for Napoleon, as recorded, pale and shaken, having had some kind of mystical experience. He started to tell his aide and then said, no, you wouldn't believe it. Even on St. Helena, in his days of exile, in one sad moment, he started to tell someone and then backed up and said, no, you wouldn't believe it. He came out of that place shaken, having undergone some strange experience. From there, he went to his attack in Russia that was his end, really. Everybody's been very excited of late because they thought that certain new scientific instruments would enable them to shoot beams and rays and calculations through that pyramid to find other cavities in it. They brought it home to universities here in the States, and the computers would play the data and it would come out different each time. And they're still stumped on it because it was a major expense research, and they have no explanation for why the instruments didn't work. Can I read to you some more? I'm going up to a prophetic thing. I'm not about to take you into this heavy because I'm going to do something in January, but I want to start baiting you with some of the areas we're going to see. Does the Great Pyramid of Cheops enshrine a lost science? Was this last remaining of the seven wonders of the world described in Greek literature, most of whom you can't find? Often described as the most sublime landmark in history, designed by mysterious architects who had a deeper knowledge of the secrets of this universe than those who followed them. For centuries, a debate has been waged between the supporters of the theory that it was built by people with super knowledge and its opponents, with eminent scientists and academicians lining up on either side. See, when I take you to the Holy Land, we're not going to mess around with the souvenir sellers and the camel rides. I mean, if you want to ride a camel, you go with somebody else. They're the most disagreeable animal this world ever produced. And it doesn't take intelligence to ride a camel, just a loose-jointed drunk. We'll go in a limousine, air-conditioned, or a bus. I'm interested in this pyramid, not the souvenir junk. Till recently, there was no proof that the inhabitants of Egypt of 3, 4, 5, it's debated, 1,000 years ago were capable of precise astronomical calculations. So I'm going to ask you a question for long. Who built this? Some godless, pre-flood character? Or did Ham build it, whose name is traced in the original naming of Mizraim, the cursed one? Did Ham build it, whose name traced to its root means the embanker, the one who drove back the sea and turned the marsh in what in ancient literature is called the Great Sea or the Great Marsh in the area that Egypt now sits in its lowlands? Ham's name is traced, and his name is given to the ancient name of Egypt as the one who was the embanker and drove the waters back. Did Ham build it? Cursed, turning bad, great-grandfather of Nimrod, producer of Canaan, the one with enmity against the promised people. Did he build it? Was it built with the help of the devil and superhuman genius as the greatest landmark on this earth to the heathen sun worship, as the remaining and much greater effort of man's activity than the Tower of Babel ever could be? Or was it built by a God-directed, angel-helped, genius-given supernatural directions? God gave the directions to Moses. When he built the tabernacle, God said, build it exactly. Did Enoch build it? He sure was on talking terms with God. How many know Enoch walked and talked with God and was not? For God took him. You know, it's late. I don't expect you shallow ones to stay with me. I'm going to sort some of you out tonight as I anticipate what's coming around the bend. Did Enoch build it? Did Shem build it? That one good son of Noah, that is the one that killed Nimrod and restored a bit of the priesthood again. Did Noah build it? Did Noah build Kenosis, that great city on Crete, and also build the pyramids, if they were built after the flood? If they were built before the flood, was it Enoch? Or was it some of these offspring of the sons of God? It was attributed to chance that the foundations were almost perfectly oriented to true north, that its structure, centuries before modern mathematicians coming out of the medieval period or the Middle Ages discovered pi, that constant factor that nobody can really explain, but the constant factor which, if you multiply it by the diameter of a circle, will give you the circumference. That great breakthrough in mathematics that changed the measurements of the world, that has a scientist in modern history identified as discovering it. The person who built the pyramid knew all about it. Its structure incorporated a value for pi, the constant for which the diameter of a circle may be multiplied to give its true circumference. Are you too far out of early grammar school and high school math to not know what pi is? Everybody know what pi is? The constant, accurate to several decimals and in several distinct and unmistakable ways. This is going to be heavy right here. But think of this when the pyramid was built. That its main chamber incorporated the, quote, sacred 3, 4, 5, and 2 triangles. Which were to make Pythagoras famous, and which Plato and his Timaeus claimed as the building blocks of the cosmos. In short, they understood the basic elements of the most sophisticated. You don't have to understand the sentence you just read. They understood the basic elements of the most sophisticated mathematical formulations that enable us to plot the movement of the stars, the earth, the circumference of the earth, the shape of the earth. They understood it all. Chance was said to be responsible for the fact that the pyramid's angles and slopes display an advanced understanding of trigonometric values, that its shape quite precisely incorporates the fundamental proportions of the golden section today known by the Greek letter, it's the Greek letter psi, necessary. Michelangelo couldn't have done his work without it. It's the basis for all responsible architectural structures, revered equally the masters in modern architecture. According to modern academicians, the first use of pie in Egypt was not until about 1700 B.C., at least a millennium after the latest dating of when the pyramid was built, because the latest dating puts it somewhere around 2500 B.C. The theorem of those sacred numbers, the building blocks of the cosmos, was not developed until the 5th century B.C. And the development of trigonometry was attributed to Hipparchus in the 2nd century before Christ. Because of the pyramid and the compounding in recent years of the opening up and studying of the chambers and the ability with modern instruments to analyze it, the whole theory of knowledge of mathematics in that regard has had to be redone. This pyramid laid down an exact formula for the shape of the earth. It was an exact replica in mathematic formulas of the north half of the globe. They had down to less in one of the calculations than the width of a human hair. Calculations that only the last two, indeed the last millennium of this earth, was supposed to have discovered. 10 miles to the west of Cairo. On the plateau called Giza, the Arabs call it Giza, stands this pyramid. Its base covers 13 acres, 7 midtown blocks of the city of New York. From this broad area, leveled to within a fraction of an inch, more than 2.5 million blocks of limestone and granite. I mean, it was either built 2400 to 2700 B.C., somewhere around there. The flood is dated by those that believe Bishop Usher about 2483 B.C. So in the 300 years after the flood, it was built by some calculations, or it was built in the years before the flood. A plateau leveled to within a fraction of an inch. Talk about surveying instruments. More than 2.5 million blocks of limestone and granite weighing 2 to 70 tons apiece. If you'll hang in with me, I'm going to show you something in a minute. Rise in 201 step tiers to the height of a modern 40-story building, etched against the cloudless blue of the Egyptian skies. I know you've seen them in movies and on TV. I want you to get a feel for this place. In terms of solid masonry, the structure contains more stone than all the cathedrals, churches, and chapels built in England since the time of Christ. That register in your brain for a minute? With no bulldozers, no giant cranes, as we know them, no mathematical ability, Stonehenge people run around in loincloths and stone axes. As originally designed with its full mantle of polished limestone, the pyramid must have been a dazzling sight. Unlike marble, which tends to become eroded with time and the weather, limestone becomes harder and more polished. the Great Pyramid looked like when it was completed, or even for the first 1 or 2,000 years thereafter, is not recorded in history. No description of the pyramid has survived in the Egyptian texts. That tends to push it in the direction of a belief that it was built before the flood, in spite of those who think everything was destroyed. This is sort of an indestructible place, and water wouldn't do that much damage to its limestone. Legends have it painted in various colors, marked with designs, and inscribed with symbols. The first eyewitness descriptions from classical authors are pitifully sparse. Thales, the father of Greek geometry, who visited the pyramid sometime in the 6th century B.C., is reputed to have astounded its Egyptian guardians with a correct computation of its height by measuring its shadow at the time of day when his own shadow was equal to his height. But unfortunately, he left no detailed description of his visit. Herodotus, the father, in some people's minds, of modern history, who saw the pyramid about 440 B.C., by which time it was as ancient to him as his period is to us. 440 B.C. is kind of ancient to us, but it was as ancient to him as this is to us. Says that each of the structure's four perfectly triangular faces was still covered at that date with a mantle of highly polished limestone, the joints so fine they could scarcely be seen. In his history, which contains the first comprehensive account of Egypt to have survived intact, Herodotus deals with other aspects of the pyramid. Siculus, the Greek historian who lived soon after the time of Christ, described the Great Pyramid's 22 acres of polished casing stones as being complete and without the least decay. One of the writers describes a door, an opening, that you could not discern on the face, but had been located. When it was closed, you couldn't see it. Sometime during the early centuries of the Christian era, the location of that door was destroyed. Then comes the Middle Ages, when the church, before it started joining the world, overreacted against it and destroyed everything. They destroyed and sacked the Library of Alexandria, made it a sin to visit the pyramids, and the only breakthrough that began to research him came with the Arabs. When the followers of Muhammad swept into power in the Near East in the 7th century and captured Alexandria, it was those Arabs, Abdullah al-Mamun, who determined that he would get into this pyramid. He ran an up-to-date intelligence service, it says, under the direction of his postmaster general, employing as many as 1,700 old women as intelligence agents in Baghdad alone. I mean, that's a smart man. I mean, if you want a good intelligence service, employ 700 old women, 1,700 old women that have nothing to do but talk and gossip. Thank God I don't have any like that in my King's House crowds. Through these 1,700 women, he was informed that the Great Pyramid was reputed to contain a secret chamber with maps and tables of the celestial and terrestrial spheres. Although they were said to have been made in the remote past, they were supposed to be of great accuracy. The chamber was also reported to contain vast treasures and such strange articles as, quote, arms that would not rust, end quote, meaning what he was looking for in munition arms, and glass, which is malleable or bends and will not rust and will not break. The arms will not rust and the glass will not break. Arab historians have recounted the tale of al-Mamun's attempts to enter the pyramid. Now, all this has been dug out. You can't believe the price that has been paid, and they've only scratched the surface of this pyramid. So I anticipate, so you don't go to sleep too quick on me tonight. When they begin to uncover the chambers, prophecy teachers, particularly those in England, when this began to come to light, who were also profound and respected scientists, conceived as one explanation of the pyramid that someone with superhuman ability prior to the flood, who walked and talked with God like a space capsule. You know, this is modern terminology to you. If you want to encase a space capsule that will preserve the learning and the knowledge of this generation, faced with the Holocaust possibility of atomic warfare. Now, we know from the promises of God that God will not let the world be destroyed. He'll shorten the time at the end, because man's learning and man's badness will have advanced that if God doesn't shorten the time, there's a danger man will wipe man out. But remember, Enoch he got a promise. When his kid was born, God told him to name the kid, and the name of the kid was Methuselah, which means when he dies, the end comes. So here's a man who lives. How long did Enoch live? He's no dummy, you know. Enoch lived one whale of a long time. And there's probably no better use of the word whale than that. He lived one whale of a long, long time. And Enoch lived 65 years and begat Methuselah. Now, Methuselah is the oldest one of the bunch, because God in His grace, once He said when he dies, He's going to wipe the world out, that tells you God's grace that He let the man whose lifespan determined how long before God wiped the world out, He let him live longer than anybody. God's long-suffering patience. Enoch lived 65 years and begat Methuselah. And Enoch walked with God after he begat Methuselah 300 years and begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And you don't read, and he died. He didn't live as long as the others, but he didn't die. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Enoch walked with God. Now, wait a minute. I just beat my head trying to get out of this book knowledge from God. I have studied all my life. Man, to walk with God. Talk about getting smart. And having 300, how much was it? 300 and how many years? 365 years. And he knew the world was coming to an end. Now, there are some who conjecture that he may have built his space capsule, and he put in it, as they unearthed the chambers, they worked out. Now, don't you listen close to me. Gene Scott will never go off on some crazy tangent. That's why I don't tell you some other books to read. I stay with the book of God. I just want to intrigue you with the mysteries of this pyramid and the alternatives that have come across the minds of men about it. The chambers of this pyramid, when they finally opened them up, offered a formula for the whole prophetic structure of the world laid out in 7,000 years. Now, I said the other night, if a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years, and He rests on the Sabbath, There is just the possibility, speculation. And you'll always hear me distinguish between speculation and what thus saith the word of the Lord. And any private revelation that someone claims had better conform to thus saith the word of the Lord, because if an angel comes say anything else, you're to say, let him be accursed. But at this 11:30 night, instead of listening to some of the other junk on TV, let me lead you down these trails. If a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years, and he rests on the seventh day, and the millennium is 1,000 years, maybe, if this old earth is rocking and rolling toward the end of the sixth millennium, and somebody walked with God to whom God was kind enough to reveal his ways, and he sealed this, quote, space capsule, and it was built with the superhuman knowledge of an Enoch. I'm having fun tonight. I've only done this one other time since I've been here, as I recall, when I preached on Saturn this one Sunday morning. He said, let me have some fun. I mean, I haven't been in school so long. Let me have some fun with a few people willing to do it with me. I also told you there's other alternatives. That these pyramids are the creation of a devil-inspired genius. As the devil, who would be like God, having been cast out of heaven, has been fighting ever since to one-up God in his caricatured imitation. Maybe this pyramid is the crowning architectural evil genius of Satan, built by some evil offspring of Satan before the flood, or built by Ham, the cursed one, after the flood, which would explain the evil, shaken experience that occurred to Napoleon, and he went out to his evil deeds, would explain the effect it had on Alexander the Great, would explain it being the source of Freemasonry, and the role that they played in the American Revolution, and the imagery on the dollar bill that you look at and don't pay much attention to, and the symbols of sun worship and the false religion that will reach their paramount position. In the book of Revelation. Dag nabbit, I want you to get my budget done so I can teach. Centuries it took to uncover these chambers that are evil designs or prophetic pictures. And do you know, if you listen to me enough to know, that the devil's caricatures are always just so close but a little out of focus? I never had so much fun in my life. In 820, the young caliph collected a vast conglomeration. This Al-Mamun's attempt, the guy who hired the 1,700 old women, and they gossiped and told him about the treasures there. He hired a vast conglomeration of engineers, architects, builders, and stonemasons to attack the pyramid. For days they searched the steep, polished, because it was covered with limestone then, the steep, polished surface of the northern slope for its secret entrance, but could find no trace of it. I want to go in 1982. I'm getting eager to go. Not to be thwarted, Al-Mamun decided to burrow straight into the solid rock of the structure in the hope of running across some passage within the interior. You got a picture of how big it is? I gave you that a minute ago. Hammer and chisel would not dent the huge blocks of limestone, no matter how many blacksmiths stood ready to sharpen them. So a more primitive but effective system was used. Fires were built close to the blocks of masonry, and when these became red hot, this is 820 A.D., they were doused with cold vinegar until they cracked. Then battering rams knocked out the fragmented stone, the first break in the limestone. For over 100 feet, Al-Mamun's men tunneled into the solid core of the pyramid, excavating a narrow passage that became hotter, dustier, and more constricted. Boy, I got claustrophobia when I read this. Just imagine this. Excavating a narrow passage that became hotter, dustier, and more constricted. Illumination by candle or flare consumed oxygen and poisoned the air. Al-Mamun was on the point of giving up when a workman heard a muffled sound of something heavy falling somewhere within the pyramid east of the tunnel. Renewing their efforts and altering the direction of the bore. See, not just a big old four-sided triangle. Built either 2,400 or 3,000 or 5,000 years ago. Renewing their efforts and altering the direction of the tunnel, the workers broke into a hollow way, exceeding dark, dreadful to look at, and difficult to pass. It was a passage. I can just see snakes and bugs already. It was a passage 3.5 feet wide by 3 feet 11 inches high. Which sloped at a steep angle of 26 degrees. On the floor lay a large prismatic stone which had been dislodged from the ceiling of the passage. Struggling up the passage on all fours, the Arabs discovered that secret entrance that had been lost about 90 feet to the north. It had been placed 49 feet above the base of the pyramid, 10 courses of stones higher than where he had started boring in. So the first tunnel was just knocking it through. Then they worked back up the passage they broke into and found that secret opening that had disappeared from history. Retracing their steps, Al-Mamun and his men groped down. Boy, what men will do for gold. Groped down the low, slippery, descending passage cut deep into the rock of the plateau. At the bottom, they were disappointed to find nothing but the unfinished, roughly hewn chamber or pit with an uneven floor containing nothing but debris and dust. Now remember, they're in the beginnings of an intricate pattern of inside passageways, markers, and developments that will totally support a prophetic pattern of history of 7,000 years. They're just now starting to find the way. I got people out there going to say, I knew it. Scott's finally going to go off the deep end. Just wait. Retracing their steps, Al-Mamun and his men groped down the low, slippery, descending passage. And all they found was this roughly hewn chamber or pit with an uneven floor containing nothing but debris and dust. On the far side of it, now imagine, they're way inside this big, monstrous, how many blocks? Write this down so I don't have to go back. 13 acres, 7 midtown blocks of the city of New York. The height of a modern 40-story building. How high is the building downtown here in L.A.? What's the highest one? I made the point. They're high. Now, they're in here with torches. 3.5 feet by 3 feet 11 inches. On the far side of it, an even narrower horizontal passage. Now it narrows up to a little horizontal passage. Led 50 feet to a blank wall. Now they're just going in for the first time. Never know when a snake's going to rear his head. A scorpion going to bite. I mean, if you think those people in Raiders of the Lost Ark got a scare when they dropped down that little hole, that ain't nothing alongside this. In the floor, a well shaft appeared to have been carved to a depth of 30 feet, leading nowhere, appeared. From torch marks on the ceiling, the Arabs deduced that the pit had been visited prior to them. Because prior to medieval time, that secret opening had been known and disappeared. So way back somewhere, that pit had been visited in classical times, and anything of interest it may have contained had long since been removed. What now intrigued the Arabs was the large prismatic stone. Thank God for Arabs that crawl around caves. They found the Dead Sea Scrolls, they find everything, looking for money. Or oil. What intrigued the Arabs was the large prismatic stone that had fallen from the ceiling of the descending passage. It had evidently covered the end of a large rectangular red and black granite plug, which completely filled what looked like another passage sloping up into the body of the pyramid. And here they see what looks like another passage plugged with granite. Some intelligent person plugged it. Now, if you don't want your time capsule or your space capsule found prematurely, you're going to plug, you're going to make it hard to get there. These plugs have, they've gotten past the plugs now, centuries. He got by them, this Arab did. Why the plugs? Mystified people. And they've even reconstructed how those plugs from where we're going to go in a few minutes, maybe, were set up to fall down and plug that passageway. How many of you saw Raiders of the Lost Ark? Remember how it opens? That stone that rolls after him and seals that place? It's like that. Plugs like that. It had evidently covered the end of a large rectangular red and black granite plug, which completely filled what looked like another passage sloping up into the body of the pyramid. Now they're going into the guts and innards of it. Of such a passage, there had been no mention in the writings of Strabo, who was the one that mentioned that secret opening on the outside, or other classical authors. You want me to quit? You want me to quit? I can shut you off and still talk to them. Al-Mamun figured he might have stumbled onto a secret which had been kept since the original construction of the building. Because their boring had broken loose this covering in the ceiling that opened up what looked like a passage that was plugged with granite plugs. Not just loose rocks, perfectly shaped granite plugs. And if they hadn't bored the way they bored, shaken loose the covering, it might not have been discovered. The Arabs tried to chip or dislodge the granite plug, but it was tightly wedged of indeterminate length, and it evidently weighed several tons in there in the middle of it. I mean, did the guy they buried there plug it up after his grievers left? Spurred by the prospect of a new passage leading to some hidden treasure chamber, what money will do? Al-Mamun ordered his men to cut around the plug through the softer limestone blocks of the surrounding walls. Even this turned out to be more of a job than expected. When the Arabs had bored beyond the first granite plug for over 6 feet, they encountered a second granite plug. Boy, whoever did this, I'd like him to hide my money if I had any. Equally hard and equally tightly wedged. When they bored around that one, beyond it lay a third. By now, the Arabs had tunneled more than 16 feet. Beyond the third granite plug, they came upon a passage filled with a limestone plug which could be cracked with chisels and removed piece by piece. So they didn't have to bore around it. They could just cut through the plug. It's not recorded how many such plugs the Arabs encountered, but they may have had to clear a score or more. 20 plugs. Before they could force their way into a narrow ascending passage this time. Again, less than four. Now, we won't have to go in via that passage. I want you to know that. They could force their way into a narrow ascending passage, again less than 4 feet high and equally narrow. On their hands and knees, holding their torches low, Al-Mamun and his men were obliged to scramble up 150 feet of dark, slippery passageway at the same exact steep slope of 26 degrees before they could raise their heads and stand on a level spot. Do you know 26 degrees is pretty steep? In front of them now stretched, they were standing finally on a level spot, in front of them now stretched another low horizontal passage, no higher than the one they had painfully ascended. I get the heebie-jeebies just thinking at that point. Inching their way to the end of this passage, they found themselves in a rectangular limestone room with a rough floor and a gabled limestone roof. Now, they're subsequently going to find a big room that doesn't have a gabled roof, because what they've come to call, thinking it was burial chambers, is the queen's room. Had a gabled roof. The king's room didn't. This was the queen's, as it came to be called. Maybe built only for burial places. Maybe. Let me quit. Because of the custom among the Arabs of placing their women in tombs with gabled ceilings. You notice why they say that? The Arabs assumed. Hey, it wasn't Arabs that built this pyramid. They called it the Queen's Chamber because they thought it was a tomb. A lot of people thought a lot of things. During the Middle Ages, they thought it was the granaries built by Joseph to store the grain during the 7 years of plenty so they could hold it during the 7 years of famine. It wasn't. They called it the Queen's Chamber. The bare room, 18 feet long and almost square. Now they got space to stretch. Had an empty niche in the east wall large enough to have contained an over-life-size statue. Thinking the niche might conceal the entrance to a second chamber, the Arabs hacked their way into its solid masonry for another yard before giving up. Retracing their steps to where they had left the low ascending passage, all they accomplished now was get into this bare room with a gable ceiling. Now they retrace their steps. All of this is going to be part of the roadmap of prophecy. The Arabs raised their torches into an ominous void among them, or above them. In the side walls, joist holes indicated that the floor of the ascending passage had once continued upwards, blocking and hiding the low passage to the Queen's Chamber. You see, when they came to the level spot, they went sideways to the Queen's Chamber. Now they're back to this ascending passage. And they see that there's a low passage. Climbing on each other's shoulders and raising their torches, the Arabs now saw that they were at the bottom of a narrow but grand gallery about 28 feet high, which appeared to stretch upward at the same steep slope as the ascending passage into the black and mysterious heart of the pyramid. The center of this new passage was very slippery, but to either side of it were two narrow ramps slotted at regular intervals for someone to walk on. Holding their torches high, the Arabs proceeded. Give me a camera over here. I'm going to show you some drawings of what it looks like. Holding their torches high, the Arabs proceeded to escalate these ramps at the end of another 150-foot climb, They came upon a huge solid stone. Now, if you just tuned in, there ain't no way you can catch me. Just see me tomorrow. At the end of another 150-foot climb, they came upon a huge solid stone raised 3 feet from the floor. They had to clamber up on top of it in order to stand at the top of the gallery on a 6 by 8 foot platform. Beyond this platform, the floor continued level. Here they go. We're going to talk about the bats in a minute. Look at them climbing up with the bats flying. See them going up that narrow one? There's the bats. Now go to the right and you'll see the artist's drawing of the one they were going up with those things on the side to put their hands in. I mean their hands and feet in. So they sort of went up like so. Beyond this platform, the floor continued level. Here's a better picture of those four Arabs trying to get up that thing. You'll see one of them, if you can zoom in on the upper part of the picture, going up the area that had the footholds. The ceiling fell now to a mere 41 inches. That's 3 feet 5 inches. Forming a small entrance into a small antechamber. Past that entrance, Al-Mamun's men were again obliged to stoop along a short passage which led to yet another chamber. Their torches revealed a great and well-proportioned room. The walls, floor, and ceiling were all of beautifully wrought and polished red granite blocks, squared and extremely finely jointed. Described as a right noble apartment, 34 feet long, 17 broad, 19 high. Because of its flat ceiling, the Arabs called it the King's Chamber. Al-Mamun's men frantically searched every cranny of the chamber, but could find nothing of interest or value. There was no sign of any treasure. Only a large, lidless sarcophagus of highly polished, dark, chocolate-colored granite. Here's a little drawing of that King's Chamber they finally got to right here. And there's the sarcophagus. Now, you remember, they bored a hole through the side. They encountered a descending narrow tunnel. They went down to a pit. They had knocked something off that looked like plugs. They cut around the plugs and then went up at a 26-degree angle through a long, narrow channel, took a side road into the Queen's Chamber, which is below. They named it Queen's Chamber. Now they break into this chamber thinking they'll find the treasure, and there's this empty sarcophagus. No body, no nothing. A single empty chest. It either had nothing there or the whole place had previously been looted. But they found no evidence of that. How and by whom, it's hard to imagine, considering the enormous number of stone plugs the Arabs had been obliged to break up in order to make their entrance. Best evidence indicates that's the way it was. That's all that was there. Of course, they didn't know. They didn't know it had the exact dimensions of the Ark of the Covenant. Those Arabs didn't know that modern research would uncover 2 different cubits used in ancient literature. Ordinary cubit and what is sometimes called the sacred or the royal cubit. And to fail, it took modern archaeology and science to discover that, to unravel some of the false conjectures of measurement in the ancient world because they failed to recognize the ordinary cubit being used by people. It's like, you know, we poor dummies, we count days, 365, but mathematicians have worked out some little old leap year formula that makes up that weird little differentiation in the years that go along with the calendar. The mathematicians have figured it out for us. We just add a day in leap year. Right? We use February to adjust our little calendars. There was a royal cubit or a sacred cubit which archaeology has confirmed as the one that was used in the biblical design given to Moses, and the exact dimensions of this sarcophagus are the Ark of the Covenant. Isn't that interesting? Al-Mamun's men frantically searched. Some Arabian authors have reported that Al-Mamun found in the sarcophagus a stone statue in the shape of a man. They say that within the statue lay a body wearing a breastplate of gold set with precious stones and a valuable sword on his chest and a carbuncle ruby on his head. There's no historical evidence to support this tale. Instead, the evidence indicates to Al-Mamun it was empty. It appeared that either the vast mausoleum had been built about nothing but a simple, single, empty chest, or the whole place had previously been looted. Though how and by whom, it's repeated, hard to imagine. In a fury of disappointment, here they are in there finding their chest. Poor guys. I mean, they fought bats and vermin and stale air and darkness and bruises to find an empty square box. It's almost as good as the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, it's almost as good as the Raiders of the Lost Ark. In a fury of disappointment, the Arabs ripped up part of the floor and hacked at the beautiful granite walls, even burrowing a short tunnel into a corner of the room, all to no avail. Legend has it that to pacify his disappointed men, Al-Mamun had a treasure of gold secreted in the pyramid at night and sent his men back to find it, amounting it to just wages due his men, and palmed it off as a coincidence being provided by the wisdom and pre-knowledge of Allah. Because they'd have killed him for the digging if he hadn't hid a treasure there somewhere. For another 4 centuries, the great pile lay undisturbed on the desert's edge, its outer casing virtually intact. An Arab historian who saw the pyramid in the early 13th century compared it. Well, he was erotic, so I'll skip that. Subsequently, a series of earthquakes demolished large parts of northern Egypt, and descendants of Al-Mamun's workers wreaked their revenge on the treasureless pyramid because it became the folly of Al-Mamun's men. I mean, they found nothing but an empty box. So they wreaked their vengeance by stripping it of its precious limestone casing to rebuild their new capital city, El Kahira, translated the Victorious. In the course of several generations, they managed to remove the entire 22 acres of 100-inch thick covering of the pyramid and even built 2 bridges, especially to drag the heavier stones across the river on camel trains to Cairo for the construction of a series of mosques and palaces. And here's pictures of the mosque of Sultan Hassan in Cairo, built in 1356 with limestone blocks removed from the covering of the Great Pyramid. So what you see now has the limestone covering that preserved it so tightly fitted that even the door of entrance could not be seen. The stripping of the limestone left the core masonry exposed, and around the stripped pyramid, fragments of limestone and rubble piled. Nobody cared now to re-enter the pyramid. Superstition haunted the ancient structure. It was said to be haunted by ghosts. Look, I saw the first movies of the opening of King Tut's tomb and all the superstitions. This one's much worse. Suspicion shrouded the ancient structure. It was said to be haunted by ghosts and to be alive with venomous vermin. According to the Arabs, the Great Pyramid was haunted at noon and sunset by a naked woman with large teeth who seduced people into her power and then drove them insane. When Rabbi Benjamin ben Jonah of Navarre, an adventurous 12th century traveler, reached the Giza plateau from Abyssinia, he noted that the pyramids which are seen here are constructed by witchcraft. Abu al-Latif, who taught medicine as well as history in Baghdad, summoned the courage to enter the Great Pyramid shortly after Benjamin's visit, but admitted that within its stifling interior he fainted from fear and came out more dead than alive. The pyramid's bad reputation spread so far afield that when the time capsule guy, he did his work. The pyramid's bad reputation, we should stay on my nose, spread so far afield that when the fabulous English explorer Sir John Mandeville is supposed to have visited Egypt in the 14th century, he is said to have complained he dared not enter the pyramid because it was filled with serpents. We'll enter it. I'm making you eager to go. Not until the Renaissance did a rational approach to entering the pyramid come alive. In 1638, John Greaves, a 36-year-old mathematician, an astronomer who had studied at Oxford and taught geometry in London, decided to set off for Egypt. His was no idle curiosity. Like Al-Mamun, he hoped to find in the Great Pyramid a datum that might help to establish the dimensions of the planet. Are you aware of the fact that when Columbus discovered America, they thought the earth was flat? These people knew better. Centuries earlier, although the preceding century, this is 1638, had spawned the great voyages of exploration and Magellan's crew had circumnavigated the earth, the sciences of geography and astronomy were still so much in their infancy that no one had improved on Ptolemy's or Al-Mamun's geographical degree, and hence no one knew the true circumference of the earth. The pyramid revealed it. Greaves applied for patronage, got assistance from the magistrates of the city of London. Though a bookish mathematician, he was not without courage as an explorer. At the pyramid, I'm about to the point I'm going to quit, so relax. At the pyramid, he climbed into the mound or onto the mound of the rubbish 38 feet high which surrounded it and gingerly led himself into the descending passage. Now, the Arabs were a group. This mathematician by himself. Gingerly led himself into the descending passage, creeping like a serpent, horrified to find himself in a storm of bats. I saw Lucille go like that. In a storm of bats, quote, by him, so ugly and so large, exceeding a foot in length. The second night we land, we go down there. To scare off the bats and clear the air, Greaves resorted to firing his pistols. The explosions reverberating like cannon shots in the restricted passage of the pyramid. How you doing, Lucille? Working his way downward, he's alone. Greaves reached the point where Al-Mamun's original tunnel joined the descending passage but was unable to proceed in a downward direction because of the debris left behind by Al-Mamun's men. I mean, in the Raiders of the Lost Ark, at least that hero had a blowtorch and a pretty woman with a high heel shoe he could use and a whip. Following in the Arab's footsteps, Greaves climbed around the massive granite plugs and up into the low ascending passage. Having scrambled to the top, Greaves retraced Al-Mamun's course along the short horizontal passage to the Queen's Chamber, where he found the stench of vermin so offensive he couldn't linger. Everything Greaves came across was a puzzle to him. The steepness of the grand gallery seemed to preclude its having been designed as a chamber. The difficulty of scaling its polished slope made it impractical as a stairway. Also, it was accessible only through the preceding very low passage. He admitted, nevertheless, that the pyramid was a very stately work, not inferior either in respect or richness of materials to the most sumptuous and magnificent building. Sounds like a low-key Englishman describing it. He noted it was built of polished limestone, very evenly cut, in spacious squares or tables. And he found that the knitting of the joints was so close it wasn't even discernible to the naked eye. Now, we're this far, if you want a picture of it. We're inside this monstrous pyramid. Now, they bored through, and then they discovered the passageway that goes down. And this pit down here, we're leaving out for the moment. They peered down in there. Then they go up this ascending passage. Then they take the side road over here to the Queen's Chamber. And they go back and up that funny stared thing, and they come out to the King's Chamber here, as they called it, with the empty sarcophagus in it. Now, what's the meaning of all this? And they're not done yet. Making his way to the King's Chamber, Greaves was puzzled that so incredibly imposing a structure as the pyramid should be built around a single chamber with a single empty coffer. Does that puzzle you or not? Am I the only guy interested in this? I'm going to do it anyway because I'm interested. Anybody want to leave? You go to sleep, I'll commit you forever to the interior of the pyramid. Making his way to the King's Chamber, he was puzzled. He could see no reason for its entrance or the complexity of its antechamber. Now, the Freemasons for years have claimed it was a secret pattern through which the initiates went in their degrees of mystic learning as they learned their witchcraft and the secret of the initiates. Alexander the Great was never the same after his exposure. No event in his life shook Napoleon like his time alone in that room with the sarcophagus. Being a scientist by nature, Greaves set to collecting and noting data about the building. Picking his way to the foot of the Grand Gallery, Greaves made a new and startling discovery. Right here. They missed it when the Arabs went through. Right there as you enter toward over to the Queen's Chamber. I wouldn't do this if it didn't have the meaning I'm heading for. Picking his way to the foot of the Grand Gallery, Greaves made a new and startling discovery. I got some people who want to listen to other things. They're so mad because I can't get to the point. They're just gnashing their teeth. Good. I'm going to catch you when you change the channel and tell them the secret. Picking his way back to the foot of the Grand Gallery, Greaves made a new and startling discovery. From the ramp at one side, a stone block had been forcibly removed, and a passage appeared to have been dug straight down into the bowels of the pyramid. The aperture was a little over 3 feet wide. Now, this guy's in this monstrous thing alone. Nobody's been in there for years. The aperture was a little over 3 feet wide, but his notches had been carved opposite one another on the sides of the well. Greaves lowered himself into it and descended about 60 feet. I get those jeebie-jeebies. To where the shaft had been enlarged into a small chamber or grotto. Below him, the shaft continued into the murky darkness, but the air was so foul and the bats so thick that Greaves decided to climb back up the way he had entered, puzzled by this strange feature of the pyramid. That's the way it looks right here. That's what he went down into. He found the grotto down there, lowering himself by holding on to the sides like a mountain climber, you know, working his way. with bats. Foot wide, foot long. Bats. That the well shaft was not bottomless, he established by dropping a lighted flare, which continued to flicker from its depths. It had a bottom. Outside, he climbed to the top of the pyramid. I would, too, get a breath of fresh air. Now, here's another diagram of what they had discovered. They had broken through from the outside here, come down the aperture, and then back up again. Here's the queen's chamber. Here's that strange passageway that goes into the king's chamber here. This hadn't yet come out. King's chamber here. And here's this descending passageway that he let himself in. Well, when Greaves got done, he wrote a lot of stuff. Then the biggies got involved. None other than Sir Isaac Newton. He wrote a dissertation upon the sacred cubit of the Jews and the cubits of several nations. The discovery in, quote, modern times of a distinction between the sacred or royal cubit method of measurement and the ordinary cubit. Now, Plato, the greatest philosopher, had a sign over his door that said, no geometry or don't enter here. We take for granted measurement. Today we carry our little computers around, don't even have to think. This longer sacred cubit Newton had derived from the Jewish historian Josephus' description of the circumference of the pillars of the temple at Jerusalem. Newton wrote it up, and he was preoccupied with establishing the cubit of the ancient Egyptians with no idle curiosity. They continued to go into the problems that had come about from these people, from Greaves' mathematical and scientific discoveries. But it wasn't until, and they just debated and talked about the measurements and fought and came up with theories. It wasn't until the time of the American Revolution was any further discovery of importance made at the pyramid. In 1765, Nathaniel Davison, who was later British Consul General in Algeria, was able to spend a vacation in Egypt and carefully explore the pyramid. More intrepid than Greaves, Davison lowered a lamp into the well, that place where he went down, tied a rope round his waist, and had himself carefully lowered into its ominous darkness, about 100 feet further down than Greaves went, only to find the bottom blocked with sand and rubbish. To Davison, it appeared strange that anyone should go to such an enormous amount of effort to dig a shaft almost 200 feet into the heart of the pyramid and simply come to a dead end. But there was nothing more he could do. It was extremely close and filthy at the bottom of the well, and his candle soon burned up what little air was available. Also, an immense number of huge bats made it difficult for Davison to keep his candle alight. So he laboriously made his way back to the surface. Abandoning this quest, Davison set about finding any other secret feature within the interior of the pyramid. And they've only scratched the surface, friends. I said, major government investments attempting to use modern instrumentation to find cavities within the pyramid. We're so happy with the research data they fed into the computer until it would come out one time with the same data, one answer, and the next time with a different answer. Scientifically impossible. They're still bamboozled about it. At the top of the Grand Gallery, you know what the Grand Gallery is, where the King's Chamber is, where the empty sarcophagus, the same shape as the Ark of Covenant is. Davison set about finding any other secret features within the interior of the pyramid. At the top of the Grand Gallery, he noted that his voice was answered in a curious way by repeated echoes which appeared to resonate from somewhere above him. Placing a candle at the end of two long canes, Davison was able to spot a small rectangular hole about 2 feet wide, this time, at the very top of the Grand Gallery, where its wall joined the ceiling. To reach this hole was a precarious ordeal. Do you realize how many centuries the time capsule planner had kept the secrets? The walls of the gallery were polished and slippery. The perch upon which he had to place his ladder was extremely small and stood high above a yawning drop of 150 feet. Nevertheless, Davison managed to raise seven short ladders till the topmost reached the small rectangular hole. There's a picture of him doing it. Ladders tied together with ladders that they had brought through that little... I mean, you don't really think. They didn't have modern aluminum ladders that sort of telescope. Davison climbed this rickety ladder combination with difficulty. At the top, he found he was prevented from entering the 2-foot hole by some 16 inches of bat dung, which had accumulated through the centuries. Folks, they cleaned it up. Don't get nervous. It's cleaned up now. Masking his face with a kerchief, Davison managed what people will do, managed to wedge himself into the stifling passage and crawl 25 feet to a chamber not high enough to stand in, but every bit as wide as the king's chamber below it. Beneath the bat dung, Davison was able to make out a floor consisting of the tops of 9 rough-hewn monolithic granite slabs, each weighing up to 70 tons or as much as a modern railway engine. You know when this was built? The undersides of these slabs formed the ceiling of the king's chamber. To Davison's amazement, the low flat ceiling of the chamber was also constructed of another similar row of granite monoliths. Here's the chamber named after him with a bunch of bats pictured that come out of the place. See his little narrow chamber? King's chamber. And he had knocked the hole and gone up there and found this little other little hole. These are the bats. They look delightful. I'm having a good time. Otherwise, Davison could find nothing of either historical or architectural interest. Listen close. No treasure. They didn't find it the first time. No treasure. No inscription. No gold. No jewels. His sole reward was to carve his graffito on the wall and have the newly discovered chamber named Davison's Chamber in his honor. When the American Revolution was followed by the French, Napoleon set out to spread his political doctrines of Freemasonry. Interest was rekindled in the pyramid. Napoleon went with about 175 intellectuals he took with his soldiers, scattered throughout the fleet. When they arrived at the Great Pyramid, they were attacked by 10,000 Mameluke horsemen. The slaughter represents one of the greatest and most terrible of history. Renowned for having withstood the hordes of Genghis Khan, they were no match for the French sharpshooters and cannoneers. In 2 hours, 2,000 Mamelukes were killed for 20 Frenchmen. And Bonaparte's general staff then arrived at the pyramid. Now here they are in perspective, arriving at that pyramid in picture form, upper picture. No, spread it wide, that's the one. Now they really start getting into this. They really start getting into this pyramid. They measure it outside, inside. They discover the marvelous triangulation, the perfection of it being a benchmark, the way it's laid out, oriented to the 4 cardinal points of the compass. It was the benchmark from which every piece of property could be in Egypt laid out. And the pyramid, in its perfection, suddenly begins to start looking like not necessarily a tomb, but a metric monument designed to embody and perpetuate a system of measures. They finally give up on the theory that it's just built as a tomb. and they start thinking it's just a modern or a monument to measurements. That's part of it. Probably Napoleon did more to start, here's Napoleon's own notes of his studies of this pyramid that fascinated him so greatly. By the way, it fascinated Adolf Hitler with equal emphasis, and Alexander the Great with equal emphasis. And remember this, it is the demon that empowered Alexander the Great that will empower Antichrist. I'll give you one more thing. After the French were defeated at Waterloo, a Genoese Italian merchant, Caviglia, arrived in Egypt. He's tired. I got to quit or can I finish? I think I'll quit. You want a break? Want a restroom break? You have recess when you're at school. We sing a song, you know. Caviglia arrived in Egypt, master of Maltese vessel flying the British flag. Seized by the mystery of the Great Pyramid, he gave up the sea and settled down to exploring the pyramid. Caviglia cleared out the bat dung from Davison's chamber. Thank God that's gone. And set up housekeeping within it, turning the gloomy recess into a residential apartment. Though how this was accomplished under a 3-foot ceiling is not explained. Alexander William Crawford, later Lord Lindsay, who encountered Caviglia in Cairo, found the Italian to be a deeply religious man, well versed in the Bible, which he constantly quoted, and also a man with some pretty strange ideas about what he'd find in the pyramid. Now we're getting hot. Getting hot, getting warmer. To England, Crawford wrote, Caviglia told me that he had pushed his studies in magic, animal magnetism, to an extent which nearly killed him, to the very verge, he said, of what is forbidden man to know. But it was only the purity of his intentions which saved him. Caviglia was convinced that if he dug into the pyramid, he would eventually encounter a secret room. To find it, he hired a gang of Arab workmen to dig a tunnel leading off from Davison's chamber. No matter how far they dug, they found nothing but solid masonry. At last, Caviglia was obliged to give up the job. To console himself, he set about analyzing the mystery of the well. That one, you remember that shaft? Lowering himself down the shaft, Caviglia, at least he didn't ask the Arabs to do it, Caviglia got as far as 125 feet below the grotto, only to find, as Davison had before him, that the bottom was completely stopped, and that the air was so scarce his candle sputtered, making it difficult for him to breathe. However, the bottom appeared to be mostly sand and loose rocks. Caviglia was determined to unplug it and see where it led. For a while, he managed to impress a gang of Arabs into raising basketfuls of the sand all the way up to the top of the well. But the shaft was so tight, the air so fetid with bat dung, and the dust so suffocating, that the Arabs began to faint and refused to work further. I got some preacher friends I'd like to take on a tour of that well. Caviglia attempted to clear the air at the bottom of the well by burning chunks of sulfur, but it was still impossible to breathe that far down for any length of time, and the Arabs would not resume their digging. Caviglia decided to attack the problem from a different angle. He would attempt to clear the main descending passage to the subterranean pit, which had been filled since Al-Mamun's time with the refuse of the plugs they had broken out of the ascending passage. Remember, they didn't go all the way down to that lower area, and they carved out around the plugs, and that filled with not plugs cut to size, but debris. Caviglia had the refuse carried up and out of the pyramid and was able to push his way on hands and knees down the passage for 150 feet. Then the air became so impure and the heat so great that he started to spit up blood. Still, he would not give up. I'm going to quit right there. Come and sing Peace in the Valley. I'm going to quit. I mean, if there isn't anybody out there going to call me and tell me, you don't even have to be heard. I just want you to ring and say, "Hey, I'm awake." That's all you got to do is ring, say, "I'm awake," and then hang up. But if I don't see some phones light up, I'm going home. Bring me some of those messages. I want to see what they said. Let's see what these people said. I believe that people aren't dumb out there. Look at all those calls. Well, I just passed the word "hey." Somebody said "hey." "Hey, I'm awake. I'm still awake in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Hey, I'm awake. Better not stop or we'll send you a case of bats." "Please, I'm not a King's House, but I can't sleep now. Don't you dare quit." From Pacifica. Just a funny bunch. Well, one person's in a tabernacle offering. He sent me a pyramid offering. It's going to be too many units to for your bank account to cover. I'll read these later. Anybody talking over there? Where were we? Oh, yeah. The heat was so great and the air so impure, he started to spit up blood. You know where he's at, don't you? He's down there now underneath. Still, he would not give up. At the end of another 50 feet, it made a discovery which seemed to indicate he might be on the right track. On the west side of the passage, he found a low doorway leading into a hole. As the Arabs began to dig upward into this hole, Caviglia noted a strong smell of sulfur. It occurred to him he might have hit upon the solution to his previous problem. The smell of sulfur might be coming from the bottom of the well where he had dropped it earlier. Got that? Which means it must be close. Digging harder, the Arab workmen dislodged some loose earth. A pile of dust and rubbish fell onto them, including a basket and ropes which had been left at the bottom of the well. There was also a sudden gush of air up the tunnel, and those in the passage were able to breathe with ease. Caviglia had discovered the end of the well, but a greater mystery remained. Why had it been dug there? When? By whom? I mean, they didn't make it to the lower passage, which would have taken them out past the plugs. Why that well? Now, there are students of theology in England that figured it out. As Caviglia set about resolving his mystery, another strange figure joined the research. Richard Howard Vise, or Vice, whatever it is, V-Y-S-E, a British Guards officer, grandson of the Earl of Stafford. You people carried away with all the marriages and things, trace all these things back. He saw the pyramids on a moonlit ride from across the Nile in November 1836. He became fascinated. They decided they'd dig around Davison's chamber again. The colonel had relays of men work day and night digging up the floor in front of the niche. Now, the poor old Italian had turned it into an apartment. Now they're going to ruin it. But all they found was an old basket, so they refilled the hole. In Davidson's chamber, they found a crack in the ceiling through which they could run a reed about 3 feet long. Believing this to be an indication of a similar chamber above, the colonel had the workmen chisel their way into the granite over their heads. But the stone was too hard, and again the Arabs couldn't stand the heat and the restricted space of Davison's low ceiling chamber. Special quarrymen were imported from the hills across the valley. When even they couldn't manage the job, the colonel resorted to gunpowder to blast his way upward. To handle the charges, he found a workman called Dowd who lived mostly on hash and alcohol. Dowd successfully set off the blast. I mean, there were guys getting high in those days and doing foolish things too. A job that was particularly dangerous as the splintered gravel flew about like shrapnel as he puffed away on his hash. When the dust subsided, the colonel found they had indeed broken through to another chamber, which he chauvinistically named after Wellington. Its floor was the top of the 8 monolithic blocks of granite. Remember, each one of them was the size of a locomotive, which formed the rough-hewn ceiling of Davison's chamber, each block weighing over 50 tons. About a yard above them lay another flat ceiling made of 8 blocks of granite, so he had another chamber now. The new chamber had a strange effect on those who entered. It turned them black. I'm going to quit right there. It turned them black. Instead of bat dung, the floor was covered with a thin black powder. Sorry, I'm going to ruin it. I'm going to ruin it. That is not the origin of the black race. I'm sorry. Good enough for them, though. In that place, they got all turned black. Instead of bat dung, the floor was covered with a thin black powder, which when analyzed, turned out to be the cast-off shells and skins of insects. Of living insects, there were none to be found. All dead. Convinced that the monoliths of the ceiling were in turn the floor of a third chamber, the colonel ordered the blasting resumed. So out comes the hash and the alcohol. The colonel's excavations above the king's chamber became more and more difficult as they rose vertically to a height of 40 feet. Let me show you. He uncovered not one, not two, but this is the way it looked when he got done. See how many chambers? Davison's the first one, then the second one, then the third one, then the fourth one, then a big one up here. Way up there. Now let me skip along because let me go to an even higher one. Further discoveries continue to uncover as you move right on up. Just right on up. No treasures in any of them. No money. Look how barren. Empty tomb. The most interesting discovery was not so much the chambers themselves, but some red paint markings daubed on the inner walls of the upper chambers. Thanks to the Rosetta Stone, which was as significant in decoding the hieroglyphics of these areas as the alphabet that has been discovered, Linear B, in other areas, this enabled them to decipher the hieroglyphics. The Rosetta Stone, thanks to it, not found here, they were able to decipher these hieroglyphics. One of them was recognized by Egyptologists as belonging to Khufu, believed to be the second pharaoh of the fourth dynasty called Cheops by the Greeks, whose reign was, mark this, Thought. to have occurred in the third millennium before our era. That's 3,000 years back. There is, of course, no way to prove that this Khufu, whomever he was indeed the Cheops. I mean, it could have been Enoch. Could have been some unknown superhuman helped person prior to the flood. Could have been Ham. Could have been Noah. Noah lived a long time after the flood. Could have been any one of these people. My mother's already choosing up sides over there. She's already choosing up sides. Could have been Noah. Could have been Ham. Don't jump too quick, anybody. Even my mama, don't you jump too quick. Could have been Noah. Could have been Ham. Could have been Enoch. Could have been Cheops. Could have been anybody. I'm having so much fun. I didn't build it. Really. I've just been here a little while. One thing seemed clear. Whoever daubed these things on the inner walls of the upper chambers must have done so before the chamber was sealed, or else somebody got in there. And somebody might have got in there and tripped the mechanisms that let the plugs loose. Or maybe the fail-safe guy plugged it. Another remarkable discovery made by the colonel in the walls of the King's Chamber was to vindicate a former hypothesis of one Dr. Harvey. Greaves had found the 2 9-inch wide openings in the side walls of the King's Chamber, but it was not until Mr. Hill, one of the colonel's assistants, who ran a hotel in Cairo, climbed high up on the outer surface of the pyramid and found two similar outlets way up there, that it was established they were connected for over 200 feet right through solid masonry to the holes in the King's Chamber. The colonel's engineer Paring was nearly decapitated when a stone dislodged by Hill came crashing all the way down one of these conduits and zipped out through the hole in the King's Chamber and hit him in the head. Somebody behind me said, "Oh God." From bats to falling rocks 200 feet down a whistling hole. When the conduit was cleared, an immediate rush of cool air entered the King's Chamber. Remember, for centuries, one opening was lost. Only found when these people bored in happened to hit it. Now they find these two little holes because they had found inside a hole. And when they fiddle around with it, a rock comes down through it, nearly decapitates the engineer, and when it was cleared, an immediate rush of cool air entered the King's Chamber. Thus ventilated, the temperature of this chamber in the center of the pyramid was to remain at an even and pleasant 68 degrees, irrespective of the weather or season outside. Never changing from 68 degrees. A prehistoric system of air conditioning. I mean, maybe, Mom, a fellow that learned to live in a boat with as many stinking animals as Noah did developed a premium on air conditioning. My mother's already voted, though. She says, "Ain't Noah." This added substance to the theory that the chamber might have been the repository for weights and measures which require an even temperature and constant barometric pressure. Now, we run around with our little amateur measuring devices, but if you really want to measure, you got to have an even temperature. Anybody knows that a measuring instrument changes in size with temperature? Such as the Paris Observatory for Measurement of Standards, which is 85 feet below ground. Hey, these are centuries old. Even more sensational for those who have bent on unraveling the secrets of the pyramid was the next discovery of the colonel. Let me quit. 40 to 1. Huh? What? Finish the book? No, when I get over here, I'm going to just talk. This little narrative portion is so interesting, it gets pretty technical. It's interesting. Ever since the Middle Ages, when the Arabs had despoiled the outer casing, the whole perimeter of the base of the pyramid had been heaped high with fragments of limestone, often piled high as 50 feet. People argued that they didn't have that covering. This time, the colonel decided to clear away a patch of debris in the center of the north facade to see if he could get down to the very base and bedrock of the pyramid, which began a whole new study of the pyramid, by the way. In doing so, he was to make a great discovery. Two of the originally polished limestone. It's like now that the Jews, since the Six-Day War, got all of Jerusalem, the importance of them honoring the command of God that when they go to that temple and pray, He will answer them. The Wailing Wall, dug down, finally has gotten them down to the large stones of the old Solomon temple. Likewise, the digging got them down to where he made the great discovery. Two of the original polished limestone casing stones on the lowest level of the pyramid were still in the spot where they'd been originally placed. Now, this is critical for the measurements. They had to have the perfect limestone smooth coverings to start getting at the perfection of the measurements of this pyramid. This ended the argument about the casing. It's silenced forever. Those who continued to consider it a fiction that the whole of the pyramid had once been covered with a fine mantle of limestone. Do you know that Abraham, in his old age, as I said earlier, could go to that place where he built the altar and climb Mount Gerizim and see that pyramid reflected in the sun and take a sighting? You know, when the ships left Knossos in Crete, that I'll argue with even my mother, Noah built. He could take his sightings on that pyramid. The original limestone was there, and so finely carved that it was now possible to correctly measure the angle of the slope on which the pyramid had been originally constructed. The blocks 5 feet high, 12 feet long, and 8 feet wide showed an angle of about 51 degrees, 51 minutes, a little sharper than the one estimated by the French. Hewn to the correct angle and polished to a uniform surface, these were quite perfect. In a sloping plane as correct and true as modern work by optical instrument makers. The joints were scarcely perceptible, not wider than the thickness of silver paper. Any builders know what I'm saying? The colonel also managed to uncover part of the original pavement on which the building rested, and which appeared to stretch away to the north. Now, I'm going to skip along. They took some of those stones from the Nile cataracts. They built perfectly level, not level in terms of the degree or angle, but the road itself level, perfectly level granite block roads. There are hieroglyphics showing the throwing of oil on the roads to make it slick, and workmen, men, pushing in uniform form, dragging these blocks on those roads constructed to get the blocks to where the pyramid was built. A poet and essayist who had never set eyes on the pyramid was to take the measurements of the colonel and others, Greaves and the scientists that had been there, and draw from Napoleon's intellectual brain trust and draw from them a set of conclusions, the most far-reaching thus far about the origin and purpose of the pyramid. John Taylor, the son of a London bookseller, whose regular job was editing the London Observer, already was in his 50s. when the colonel returned from Egypt. He was to spend the next 30 years until he was 80 collecting and comparing accounts from those who had visited the pyramid. A gifted mathematician and amateur astronomer tailor-made models to scale of the pyramid and begin to analyze the results from a mathematician's point of view. This comes out of the age when it's supposed to be cavemen. To account for the discrepancies in the length of the base reported by successive travelers, it occurred to Taylor that each measure had arrived on the scene, that as each measure arrived, more sand and rubble had been cleared from the base, and in essence, they measured from a different spot. But that suddenly solved with the colonel, who digs down and finds the platform on which it was built and the roads leading away from it. It wasn't any desert when it was built, by the way, as now. Sand wasn't blowing like it is now. Taylor was puzzled as to why the builders of the pyramid should have chosen the particular angle of 51 degrees, 51 minutes for the pyramid spaces instead of the regular equilateral triangle of 60 degrees. I mean, why do these old dummies back there in the cave age pick that? Analyzing Herodotus, that ancient Greek historian's report of what the Egyptian priests had told him about the surface of each face of the pyramid, Taylor concluded they had been designed to be equal in area to the square of the pyramid's height. If so, this meant the building was of a particular, if not unique, geometric construction, and no other pyramid ever discovered had these proportions. Taylor then discovered that if he divided the perimeter of the pyramid by twice its height, it gave him a quotient of 3.144, remarkably close to the value of pi, which is computed as 3.14159 plus. You geometry students will catch that. In other words, the height of the pyramid appeared to be in relation to the perimeter of its base as the radius of a circle is to its circumference. This seemed to Taylor far too extraordinary to attribute to chance, and he deduced that the pyramid might have been specifically intended by its builders to incorporate the incommensurable value of pi. If so, this was a demonstration of the advanced knowledge of the builders. Footnote: not till the 6th century was pi correctly worked out to the fourth decimal point by the Hindu sage Aryabhatta. It took another 1,000 years from the 6th century, 1600, before the Dutchman, Pierre Metius, calculated pi to the 6th decimals by means of the fraction 355 over 113. In 1593, Francois Viète carried the computation to 11 figures, and a generation later, Rudolf van Suylen, just before he died, took pi to 127 figures. In 1813, the English mathematician William Shanks developed pi to 707 decimals, and modern computers have carried the operation to 10,000 points of decimal, but with no solution to this apparently incommensurable number. Nobody knows why that pi divided by diameter produces the circumference of the circle, but it does. But these guys, way back there, without all those computers, I mean, if my mother's right, and it wasn't known, it was Noah, somebody heap smart like him. It had all those years to live to compound knowledge. Still today, the oldest known document, which indicates that the Egyptians had knowledge of the value of pi, is the Rhine Papyrus, dated about 1700 B.C. Therefore, much later than the pyramid. Found in the wrappings of a mummy in 1855 by a young Scottish archaeologist, Henry Alexander Rhine, the rare papyrus is now in the British Museum. It has a very rough value of pi of 3.166, or 1/6, rough value. Well, what did he find out? He found out if he divided the perimeter of the pyramid by twice its height, which would be the diameter if it were twice, if it were the top half of a circle, namely a reproduction of the northern hemisphere, if it were to be the whole globe, and he takes the pyramid as it now exists having gained the mathematical ability to measure it properly, and if he divided the perimeter of the pyramid by twice its height, it gave him a quotient of 3.144, remarkably close to the value of pi, which is 3.141. It took until the 6th century to work it out to four decimals. Now, I'm going to anticipate and tell you, they keep measuring, then they uncover the mystery. I'm going to lose my glasses and have to quit, but I'm lucky I got an extra pair tonight. They then discovered that phenomenon of the royal cube, cubic foot, cubic measurement. Got so many glasses tonight, I never mind. Nothing is going to stop me. That was made for a big head. They discovered that it was the royal cubit of measurement rather than the average one. They then discovered when the airplane was invented and a colonel at a certain time of the day flying by accident took a picture that revealed a curved inward shape to the pyramid, which accounted for some of the linear measurements. And when they corrected all of their measurements properly with the continuing scientific measuring devices and the recognition of the royal cubit element of measurement rather than the average, and the concave nature of the base, and corrected all their measurements, it came out exactly pi. Exactly what the computer now finds. Taylor discovered in his little computation, it was remarkably close. 3.144. Now, pi, you that study geometry, you know what pi is. It's the little symbol of the P in the Greek language. You take a circle, find the diameter, multiply it by pi, 3 point to those figures, and you end up with the circumference of the circle. Now, they had designed this pyramid to anticipate where I'm going on the royal cubic measurements in such a manner that when they finally deciphered what the units of measurement were in this pyramid, it was on an exact scale when multiplied that the best computers in the land today cannot improve upon the circumference, including the offness of this oval-shaped globe that modern computers can find for the shape and circumference of the earth. Perfect. Now, Mama dear, Noah floated around the whole blame thing. He knew it was round because he went round round it. I love my mother. I'm not saying it's Noah, Mom. I'm just saying, boy, that imitator, if he did it, is a good one. Oh, these glasses are going to kill me. Searching for the reason for such a pi proportion in the pyramid, Taylor concluded that the perimeter might have been intended to represent the circumference. Listen, Taylor concluded that the perimeter might have been intended to represent the circumference. Taylor concluded that the perimeter might have been intended to represent the circumference of the earth at the equator, while the height represented the distance from the earth's center to the pole. Can't see it over this one. Perhaps the ancient designers had measured the length of a geographical degree, multiplied it by 360 for the circumference of the globe, and by the pi relation had deduced the polar radius of the earth, immortalizing their knowledge by making the circumference to scale with the perimeter and the radius to scale with the height of the pyramid. Now, I'm going to anticipate you more. I'm going to tell you. Well, let me go on. Taylor underlined his thesis. It was to make a record of the measure of the earth that it was built. He then elaborated, they knew the earth was a sphere, and by observing the motion of the heavenly bodies over the earth's surface, had ascertained its circumference, and were desirous of leaving behind them a record of the circumference as correct and imperishable as it was impossible, as it was possible for them to construct. Now let's assume it's a time capsule. Old Enoch, who walked with God, knew everybody's going to be wiped out. He's preserving knowledge that had accumulated during those days before the flood. Now, if anybody out there says that I've taken a stand, I'm going to come through this TV screen at you and bring some bats with me. I'm just reporting. Just reporting. But it was evident to Taylor that the builders of the pyramid could not have used for their calculations such a unit as the British foot, which fitted neither the height nor the base exactly. He therefore looked for a unit that would retain the pi proportion and fit the pyramid in whole numbers. When he came to 366 over 116.5, he was struck by the similarity of 366 to the number of days in the year. He kept experimenting with factors. And as he experimented with factors that would give him, how in the world they worked out their measurements, because all he knew was a silly English foot. Well, he experimented, he came to the one dividing 366 by 116.5, and when he got that one, and it came out to the figure that he wanted, he then was struck, as most discoveries are the result of an accidental thing you see, by the similarity of 366 to the number of days in the year. And he wondered if the Egyptians might, in addition of having built into this pyramid all the concepts of measurement, might have also figured out all the concepts of time and calendar and year and movement of heavenly bodies. And he wondered if the Egyptians might have intentionally divided the perimeter of the period into units of the solar year. Now, to try to figure out how to make one thing encompass and reveal all of this, he then noticed that if he converted the perimeter into inches, it came to very nearly 100 times 366. Also, he was surprised to see that if he divided the base by 25 inches, he obtained the same 366 result. Could the ancient Egyptians have used a unit so close to the British inch? A cubit of 25 such inches. By coincidence, Sir John Herschel, one of Britain's most eminent astronomers at the beginning of the 19th century, had just postulated a unit half a human hair's breadth longer than a British inch as the only sensible Earth commensurable unit, or unit based on the actual size of the Earth. The measurements that had been developed through the further development of what was thought to be the beginning of mathematics in ancient Greece had produced a measuring device that just wouldn't come out, according to facts. So one of the leading astronomers at the same time that Taylor was doing this had postulated that if you set up a unit a half a human hair's breadth longer than a British inch, it would come out even with no fractions left over. This, to make a long story short, Herschel, I like anybody to criticize the French. Herschel criticized the French meter derived from a curved meridian of the earth as being erratic and variable from country to country because the earth is not a true sphere. It isn't a true sphere. You that have studied much know that. It's not perfectly round. And each meridian of longitude would therefore be different. What's more, the French had erred and produced a meter that was 2/10,000 too short. According to Herschel, the only really reliable basis for a standard of measure was the polar axis of the earth. Now, scientists for years come to this. They're discovering what the pyramid builders build into their pyramid. A straight line from pole to pole, which by the recent British Ordnance Survey had fixed at 7,898.78 miles. This translated into 500,500,000 British inches, or an even 500 million inches if the British inch were half a human hair's breadth longer. Now, the only point of this, the point of this is we are now down to a half a human hair's differentiation before computers could work things out. How did they find this little error that up until they discovered the clue, they struck a mean in the differentiations? The discovery that the ancient world used two standards of measurement. A royal, called in the Hebraic tradition, or the tradition that goes back to the measurements used with the ark, sacred. And the both were synonymous because in all the heathen countries, the king was sacred. So the sacred or royal measurement unit was a bit different than the natural measurement unit. And when they adjusted all their measurements to the royal unit, the pyramid became a perfectly placed measuring device for all standards of measurement that are right, a complete measurement device giving the exact shape and circumference of the earth, and at the same time positioned so perfectly in its knowledge of the shape of the earth that it was able to perfectly measure the days of the year without a variation anywhere. Another unexpected, Another unexpected piece, I already said this, but let me read it as he says. Another unexpected piece of evidence astounded Taylor. He discovered that recent maps produced by the British Ordnance, the largest and most expensive yet undertaken, had been done on a scale of 1 to 2500. This scale turned out to bear no relation to the standard British mile of 5280 feet, 5,280 feet, which had varied through the ages. But almost miraculously, the new scale fitted the sacred cubit as postulated by Sir Isaac Newton, as well as the British acre, one side of which was equal to 100 cubits of 25 inches. It appeared that the British inch must have been an ancient unit of measure which had lost a thousandth part as it was handed down from generation to generation, which, by the way, is one of the main arguments of the British Israelites. And as I've said, the British Israelites have some good history. They just go a little too far in the interpretation of it, because they believe that Jeremiah went down, and that's Bible, went down to Egypt with the people who disobeyed God and went down to Egypt when Zedekiah was blinded and carried into Babylon. They believe likewise that if not Jeremiah, at least Baruch, who wrote Jeremiah, with the daughters of the king, came and landed in Ireland, and the overturn of Ezekiel took it through the three kings to the present king that sits on the throne in England. And the blessings of Ephraim have descended on England, which is the lost tribe of Ephraim, and the United States is Manassas. Now, whether those interpretations of the British Israelites and the Worldwide Church of God, for example, is of that frame, are true or false, the facts behind it have solid historical substance. And there is the solid basis for believing that carried with these Jews who settled in Egypt at a time when some of this knowledge was available, carried with them this standard of measurement, which is the sacred cube, which became the British inch. Just that's parenthesis thrown in. From all his studies, Taylor concluded that the proportions of the pyramid had definitely been intended to incorporate geometric and astronomical laws simply and easily expressed, and that its purpose had been to preserve and pass on this knowledge to future generations. However, as there was nothing in Taylor's philosophy to indicate the existence in such remote antiquity of any civilization which could have had a knowledge of the true shape of the planet, its axial size, and its motion in the solar system. And as the conceit was not then current that this planet might have been visited by superior beings from some other part of the universe, Taylor was hard put to explain the sources of science he found incorporated in the pyramid. More than a scholar and a mathematician, Taylor was also a profoundly religious man, thoroughly steeped in the Old Testament, which he believed to be literally true. Now, I think Enoch could have been this smart. If he weren't, he could ask God. He walked with him. Noah could have been. He floated around. I'm not saying he was, and forbid me to go against my mother at this point. Ham could have been trying to impress his father who cursed him, building to rival what was built at Kenosis. Some superhuman beings prior to the flood. Ham certainly drove back the water and was the great embanker. Cheops could have done it. But Taylor was steeped in the Old Testament. To Taylor, the creation of Adam had occurred in 4000 B.C. and the flood in 2400 B.C. and that was that. It seemed to him hard to believe that in a mere 300 years, about 2100 B.C., man could have redeveloped to the point of building so complex a structure as a great pyramid. Ham, Noah, live another 300 years. Taylor could come but to one conclusion. Whoever had built the pyramid must have done so under the direct influence of divine revelation. Or I would say supernatural. Could have been the devil. Divine revelation as Noah had built the ark. I mean, why is it, by the way, that the evil person Cain, the arts and skills of his descendants are described with such detail in Genesis? Remember that? The descendants of Cain, they're described in great detail what his people did. Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bare Enoch and built a city. He built a city. Called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. And under, it's a different Enoch than the one that was called away, by the way. And unto Enoch was born Irad. And Irad begat Mahujael. And Mahujael begat Methusael. And Methusael begat Lamech. And Lamech took unto him two wives. The name of one was Adah, and the name of the other was Zillah, and Adah bare Jabal. He was the father of such as dwell in tents, and such as have cattle. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all such as handle the harp and organ. Zillah, she bare Tubal-Cain, instructor of every artificer in brass and iron. Why are their descendants described? Now, these are the evil cursed ones before the flood, the descendants of Cain. The ones most likely to cohabitate with the sons of God, hated by God and produce giants. Weird things. Taylor could come but to one conclusion. Whoever had built the pyramid must have done so under the direct influence of divine revelation as Noah had built the ark. In his own words, it is probable that to some human beings in the earliest ages of society, a degree of intellectual power was given by the Creator which raised them far above the level of those succeeding inhabitants of the earth. That's easy to figure out. If you live 900 years, you're going to be smarter than somebody who lives 70 years. Because of the close similarity of the British inch to the pyramid inch, that tells you about the British Israelites. First confirmation of scientific theories. I'll give you the conclusion. The sacred cubit used by the builders of the Great Pyramid was the same length, 25.025 British inches, as the one used by Moses to construct the tabernacle and by Noah when he built his ark. And because the 25th part of this cubit was within a thousandth part of being the same as a British inch, Smith also concluded that the British had inherited this sacred inch down through the ages, brought by Baruch, by Ireland, Scotland, on down into England. During the last few weeks of Taylor's life, Smith, Piazzi Smith, decided the only way to definitely confirm or refute Taylor's theories would be to go to Egypt and start with the pyramid again. In utmost strait for funds, he asked his fellows in the Royal Society of London for help. He got it. measuring the coffer in the king's chamber. To skip over, Smith concluded that Taylor had been correct in recognizing it as a standard of linear and cubic measure. Unlike the European standards, such as the yardstick kept at Whitehall, which vary with temperature and barometric pressure, shrink, decompose, tarnish, or oxidize with time, the coffer in this king's chamber appeared to be designed to remain with an air conditioning that kept it at 68 degrees at a constant temperature and barometric pressure, its polished sides unaffected by decomposition over a period of thousands of years. Not done yet. In support, well, way back when Caviglia had cleared the passage of the rubble left by Al-Mamun and opened the door on the side of the pyramid, they noticed something. Now they figured out it is a perfect measuring device. It enables a perfect measurement of the circumference. They knew about pi and the mathematical formulas not worked out until past the Middle Ages and the Age of the Enlightenment. They knew about the royal cubits. They knew about the days. Now they discover that this little passage, I'll anticipate it. When you look through that passage at a certain time of the year, you perfectly line up at a certain time of the day. You certainly line up, you perfectly line up and can sight in from that little passageway, way down at the bottom, looking out it, and perfectly line up with the Pleiades straight above the pyramid apex, and the polar star out here is perfectly lined up. Now I'm going to skip ahead and tell you some things. They discovered somebody had, as they had opened the pyramid up and were letting people in, some cat had died, and they put the cat in this conical structure in the area, the cat in the area, they had thrown it in the garbage can. And in a very short time, I got it in here how many days, weeks or whatever it was, they came back and the cat was mummified. No decomposition. They then began to experiment with the conical structure. And you'll find that some companies are experimenting with yogurt in conical little containers and milk in conical containers. They discovered that the heart of an animal or a full animal or the size of the animal, an automatic mummification occurs, no decomposition. Worked out by some strange conical composition. They then discovered that the mathematical shape of the pyramid created some mystical magnetic fields. It was from this pyramid that they discovered that a crystallization occurs, that when you set it up and a patent was issued, some of you may have seen it, on a sharpener for razor blades based upon this pyramid. Because of electrical field, magnetic field was created. One poor guy, the guy was working it out, went to the top of the pyramid and experimented with what he discovered, and with a wine bottle, and the sparks started flying out of his hands, and one of the Arabs got scared and touched him and knocked the guy down. They discovered electromagnetic fields. Science has discovered in recent years from the pyramid. Mummification automatic, air conditioning, and I haven't got time to get into the amazement of the current research that everybody's going bananas over because they were going to be able to find other cavities in the pyramid, except the computer doesn't work. It spits out. Now, this marvelous and wonderful discovery began to upset all the fixed ideas of the traditional world. The work was not well received. Smith, who went there as a scientist and came back a religious zealot, confirming Taylor's theories, unable to account for the mathematics displayed by the ancient Egyptians. Like Taylor, he was obliged to attribute this science to divine wisdom, somehow imparted to an earthly architect who had constructed the pyramid under the direct influence of revelation. To make things worse, another Scot, not by name, I'm making things worse tonight, by country, a religious enthusiast called Robert Menzies advanced the theory that the passage system in the Great Pyramid was nothing less than a chronological representation of prophecy, corroborating the Bible, built on a scale of 1 pyramid inch to the solar year. And it works out to 7,000 years, friends. As Menzies' theories was formulated before anything was known of the ancient Egyptian messianic prophecy, such as the Book of the Dead, which has subsequently been translated from the hieroglyphics. But Menzies didn't know anything about that, the text of which had not been deciphered. This new contribution added to the storm. Scientists derided and lampooned. Now they really get down to business as the religionists and the scientists begin to fight. The scientific theory develops, and they begin to measure it with modern scientific instruments. And I told you the first breakthrough was the discovery of the sacred unit of measure. Then they discovered from an aerial photo, guy flying over accidentally at a certain time of the day, caught something that was revealed by the shadows at a certain time of the day, and they discovered, get the bottom picture. You see the curving in of the base? Now get the top picture, it'll show it a little bit in a different manner. When they begin to correct all of the various measurements to make them perfect, they then were able to work out, and then they discovered the Book of the Dead, ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. I was reading from the Book of the Dead when I was telling you about some of the sun worship and the counterpart to Nimrod, Horus, and Isis, and Zeb in the Egyptian counterpart to Semiramis and Tammuz, and Nimrod. Well, the Book of the Dead brings forth and alludes to and helps to understand the interior features of the Great Pyramid alluded to in the ancient Egyptian texts, such as the Book of the Dead, according to prophetic pyramidologists. So if you take the Book of the Dead, which is Satan's construction, remember, he's the great counterfeiter. He always is like if you take a camera and look through the focus meter, get me out of focus the smallest possible bit, Peter. Just a little. There, leave it right there. I'm out of focus, you see. Take it a little more. Take it a long ways. Now that's easy to see. No fool would believe that. But get back real close, Peter. There, that's pretty close, isn't it? Now that's the territory you expect the devil to run. Remember when he's bound 1,000 years, it says in the book of Revelation he can't deceive anymore. It says when he gets out, he's released to deceive. Understand that? He's the deceiver. This is the realm he moves in. He takes God's truth and just moves him a little bit. Now I'm going to let you just see a little bit of this. I'm going to whet your appetite. This that has been discovered in the pyramid from the Book of the Dead, the secret places of the hidden God, works out all these various compartments. Here is to the hidden lintel. Here is the descent. Here is the door of ascent where salvation and knowledge moves in. This is the descent to the chamber of the ordeal. You that know mythology will know what the chamber of the ordeal is. Here's the well of life and its connections. The hall of truth and darkness. It's in darkness, but it's a hall of truth that begins to move toward the hall of truth and light. The path of the coming forth of the regenerated soul. The crossing of the pure roads of life right here. The double hall of truth. The royal ark of the solstice. The passage of the veil. The chambers of the open tomb of resurrection. I haven't told you about the top yet, have I? I ain't going to tonight. Now here is the 7,000 year prophetic ages. The evil, the present evil world on its downward Broadway slide, as my father saw in vision, to the second death. The Jewish age and the old law of the covenant. When the theologians begin to ask questions of the scientist, they ask them in one occasion, as they begin to see a certain code come forth, are there markers? So they begin to pay close attention to the descent that they just slipped and slided along, and they found markers set up on the same kind of units of measurement that were enabling them to picture how long you would be in descent, how long you would move to a certain level. And you remember, God deals with two different kinds of people. You ever heard me talk about that? Then the gospel age moves to the plane of the spirit world. The king's chamber. You have to do much thought about the king's chamber. Now, there's a lot of little detail in here, too. As the whole... Now, let's assume God walked and talked with Enoch. He's a good choice right now to think about. And didn't God tell Noah what he's going to do? You got me in focus? Didn't God tell Jeremiah there'd be 70 years in bondage? Didn't God tell Daniel that his people, that's just a little piddling part of the world, the Jews and Jerusalem would have 70 weeks of years in which God would work out the purposes of that 24th verse of that 9th chapter? Or whichever chapter it is, 24th verse, where the 70 years are unfolded, 70 weeks of years. Didn't he do that? Do you think it's possible he walked and talked with Enoch and told him about the 7 years, including the Sabbath of the millennium? And old Enoch, with God's help, built this marvelous container of the science, not even yet unraveled, just beginning to be unraveled, of mathematics, which is, whether you know it or not, the root of all knowledge, as human knowledge goes. Mathematics, astronomy, the heavenlies, magnetic fields, measurement, and preserve. How many other compartments are in here? They're trying to find out, and the machine went bananas. Contained in one marvelous structure, all the knowledge? Or was it constructed by the devil, whose pipes and tabrets were in him from the beginning, who was the crowning cherub in the mountain of God, the great counterfeit, who substitute the worship of the sun and the moon, who's guilty, as Paul says, of being the father of lies and deceit, of those who worship the creature, the creation, instead of the Creator? Was it built by the descendants of demons and Cain? Giants and superhuman demon-inspired characters prior to the flood? Was it the container of the wisdom of the ages imparted by God to some divine saint? Or was it the finest handiwork of Nimrod, sun worship, Satan-inspired, demon-inspired, devilish counterfeit religion that in its very impressiveness would by its very knowledge win the hearts of men away from God if allowed? Was it built by Noah or by Shem? The spiritual counterparts after the flood with God's help and divine illumination? Or was it built by Ham or some of his descendants, of whom Cheops was a descendant? Was it built by those that had been cursed after the flood, as Cain was cursed before the flood, again helped by Satan to build the greatest and grandest and most lasting monument to his evil purposes? Don't you want to know? Come on up, Chris. I want peace in the valley. No, no, no. Let's have everybody. I want these bones going to rise again. All the same crowd. Just lock that camera in. Get Joe in here. I'm going to quit to be continued. Now, you got to keep me alive till January to do anything with this. Did you have fun tonight? Huh? Are you curious? I mean, do you want to go to Egypt or not? You want to study this pyramid along with other things or not? Now, if everybody's interested in going in May of 1983, call. Give me your name and address. I'd like to do something besides raise money for a change. Now, Mom says it's not Noah. But it could be thus far. What I've told you thus far, it could have been Noah. It could have been Shem. It could have been Ham. Or a descendant of Ham if it was built after the flood. It could have been Cain's descendants. Could have been Enoch. I want to ask you this. Is there anybody listening in here that doesn't believe and isn't convinced that whomever built it had superhuman help? Either demoniac help, if it was built as an expression of Satan's counterpart to impress man away from God with knowledge, or built with God's divine help. The only possible alternative to that would be it's built by super human beings with knowledge that could only be accelerated and compounded by the long years of living that went on in these early patriarchs. Einstein, living 900 years, could have conceived this. This was not only conceived, but built 2,400 to 5,000 to 2,400 to 3,000 years B.C. You got that? And whichever way you interpret it, it confirms the Bible again. Because the Bible makes it clear there were some strange goings on and some superhumans and supernatural events in those days immediately before and after the flood. Now, I can't wait to unravel this prophetic timepiece. And just in case Enoch built it, or Noah built it, isn't it the devil's pattern to move in on God's territory with his bats and bat dung and his snakes and his vermin and try to take it over? Won't it be something if during the millennium Because God's going to try to convince the remainder of Russia they ought to pay attention to what He says, that He does what He says, and He's in control. By having those memorials in the valley of Gog, where the multitude of Gog was buried, Haman Gog, won't it be something if in the millennium we can tour the pyramid and God can say, just to show you, my word is forever settled in heaven. Look here, I laid down the 7,000 years right there with Enoch before I took him home. And I didn't want to leave him after he did the job to tattle in his old age. I'm having so much fun. Don't you dare say I've taken sides. I'm just reporting up till now. I'm going to take sides probably in January. Good night, everybody. Sing the song. You lost your bet. You thought I was going to check out on that song. You lost. Now, it wouldn't hurt some of you at this hour that benefit from this network, regular watchers, to pick up a phone before you go to sleep. And if you haven't told me what you're going to do in December, do it. You're still awake and appreciate the ministry of this network. We did something different tonight than we normally do, which lays some foundations for what I want to teach out of the book of Genesis as I move into it in January. I just want to impress upon you, in a day when everybody is trying to capsulize all truth into a couple of little glib sentences, let me tell you, either men of God built that pyramid or Satan-inspired geniuses built it. And it proves very positive the truth of what Paul said, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but likewise the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. There's just too much oversimplification. Things could be made simple, but they don't have to be oversimplified. The pyramid's very simple. It takes complex ideas that mathematicians worked through the centuries to discover, when all they had to do was take the pyramid as the model and use it. But it has a lot more to say about itself than these mathematical formulas. There were things going on in this world in those days as the races of mankind sprung forth, and the devil fought with God, and the devil's people fought with God's people to make sure that the true word of God was passed on. I could have just as easily read to you tonight the translation of the hieroglyphs out of the story of Gilgamesh, who found in his search for eternal life an aged man who told him about the flood and about the ark and about the release of the dove and a sparrow and finally a crow that landed on the floating carcasses and gorged himself. The religion of no religion people say these multiplication of myths just all represent proof that they're all myths. No, they don't. God chose an oracle people, and by the way, sent His chosen people down to Egypt and took Moses, trained in all the arts and sciences and wisdom of Egypt, as no other man in Egypt, to lead His people out to construct the tabernacle and the ark of the covenant on the exact dimensions of the royal cube, cubic measure rather, that was designed and used in Egypt. And God chose a people. I have no doubt at all. For years, scientists poo-pooed Homer and the fabled city of Troy, until an archaeologist dug it up and proved it. For years, people belittled the city of the king of Damascus till archaeologists proved it. For years, they belittled the location of King Solomon's mines till archaeologists proved it. And every distorted legend has a kernel of truth. I am totally convinced that Gilgamesh existed and that he saw Noah in his search. And I read this afternoon the translation of Gilgamesh inscription of his memory of the story of the flood given to him by this aged patriarch, which could be no other than Noah or one of Noah's sons. And as Gilgamesh tells it, it was the one, the counterpart to Noah, that told him the story out of Indian mythology. The difference is, Gilgamesh, when he recorded it, distorted the story. But when Moses, anointed of God, took the story that had been handed down and passed down from Noah through Shem, through his descendants, we get the true rendition. But there can be no question that throughout all the ages, Satan was seeking to twist it just a little. There are other elements to Gilgamesh's rendition. Explain the temple of the Toltecs and the Aztecs and the Mayas in the Western Hemisphere that, by the way, reveal they are but magnificent but imitations and subsequent copies of the principles of the pyramid in Egypt. There is war in the spiritual world, and it's so easy to get a little off the track. And in every age, God needs a voice of truth that hangs the plumb line down, that keeps God's word front and center in the midst of confusion that runs by feelings. I'm telling you something, friends. You can get as much feeling, if Napoleon could be shaken, you can get as much feeling in the Great Pyramid in certain places as you get in some revival meetings. You don't run by feeling, and I have nothing against feeling. It is supported by the facts of God's Word and the result of faith in God's Word if it's right feeling. But there's warfare going on. It's very important that a voice of truth stay alive. And now this breakthrough in communication in the modern world of television and radio, I keep asking myself the foolish question. Why is it that I continue to have enemies who hate me without a cause, who have no rational reason for trying to silence this voice? It's easy to figure out if I stop and think for a second. We must really be disturbing the devil's territory. And he doesn't like it. He's out to win, but he's doomed to defeat. And the same truths we're finding in Revelations, you'll find, will leap out of Genesis. God's been saying the same things from the beginning. And it's time for people to choose up sides and get on the side of truth. Now, it wouldn't hurt you that know the truth of what we're saying and support it to stick your neck out in faith and help us reach the budget. I said I'd spend 100 hours live, but I haven't raised much money tonight. I'm only about 2,000 away from the regular goal, which is surprisingly good. But some of you could help us at this late hour, because there'll be voices of faith here for the few minutes necessary to take your closing call. But this is good night. They're going to sing that chorus again. Let it go. Good night, everybody.